our civilization is built on traditions which require a lot of concentration, a lot of attention span. There would be discussions and debates go on for days. The big teachings are requiring serious thinking, concentration. So there is a degradation of the mind, quality of mind, the level of thinking has gone down. Now, when you have people like that, then in a democracy, you have to cater to such people in order to get elected. So the politicians have to become low in thinking and become emotional.
The reason for the education policy to bring in foreign universities is that many parents are spending thousands of dollars, lakhs of rupees, to send their children overseas. So why not bring those colleges and those universities onto home turf so that, you know, they can just get educated right here? But we haven't looked at what is the kind of education we're bringing in. So we don't do due diligence at all.
Any expertise, whether it is medicine, whether it is cricket, whether it is, whatever, it is not decided by democracy. The court does not decide based on a democracy, what is everybody sitting in the court, what do you think, is he right, is he guilty, not guilty. It's not decided. It's decided by people who are experts. So why couldn't governance be also by people who are real subject matter experts rather than people who are popular? We are supplying labor to the American multinationals to do the software which they will own. They are the owners of the intellectual property. They are the owners of the patent. We are supplying the labor. So just because we are supplying labor doesn't mean we own the technology. There's a difference between whose technology it is, which is American, and who is supplying the labor. So we have trained labor to get jobs and they bring repatriation of income and good for cities like this where you can apply, bring a lot of create jobs. It is good. But China not only supplied labor for factories, but they ended up outsmarting their client, outsmarting the Americans, building the products themselves. Better, cheaper to compete against them.
Pragya Bharati, in association with Bruhat, is organizing this program of Sri Rajiv Malhotra ji. Several people have come forward to support us. The list can be quite long. We will be paying our gratitude to all of them at the appropriate occasion. I welcome all the members of the press to the conference today. And may I now request Sri K. Arvind Rao Garu to give us the context of the visit briefly before we start the discussion with Sri Rajiv Malhotra ji.
Thank you, Subramanian ji. I am very glad and I feel privileged to welcome Sri Rajiv Malhotra and Professor Vijayaji here to this Hyderabad city. Rajiv Malhotraji has been visiting India for the last several years. And first of all, I will tell you my acquaintance with him. About 12 years ago, I read his book, already he had written some books. I read his book called Breaking India. About 11 years ago, I read it. And when I first read it, having worked for about more than 34 years in the police department, and that too in fairly senior level, I felt ashamed that I did not know so many things which were written in that book. Because he told about several aspects. He described several ways in which the country was being attacked. So we are not aware of it. We are aware of some limited sphere here. In fact, I personally felt that he had done a phenomenal work, what the intelligence agencies, the central intelligence agencies have to do, or what probably the foreign officers have to do. So much of intelligence collection was there, and he had written certain irrefutable things in that. He had made some strong comments on certain people who were Indian citizens only, but then who were helping outsiders, and then who were helping the Breaking India forces. So he had written something about them, and so far no one has challenged. And he had written that he had done adequate research about those things. It is not as though he is a sort of He made some wild allegations and all that. He did a lot of research, and then he produced all those details which were never challenged. So that was my first experience with Rajivji. And thereafter, I had an occasion to personally meet him in the Swadeshi Indology Conference in Delhi. So that is my acquaintance with him. Then if I have to introduce Sri Rajivji, so he has been in America for the last 50 years or so, an entrepreneur, an IT person, basically an IT person, artificial intelligence. His basic subject is that. And he also ran some companies, made some good money, but not for himself, but he was also a good donor to several universities. And in that process, he came to know, he got acquainted with some of the professors in the universities. And we all think that professors in the universities are very, very noble people. But then there are also people who have various plans. The professors in America and other Western universities, they have got their own agenda. They have an agenda to analyze a country, analyze what are all the fault lines in a country, and then see how the countries can be broken and how they can exploit the resources of that particular country for the benefit of any Western country, let us say. Not only America, but any Western country. So usually that is the approach of very many professors there. So he, incidentally, probably, he got in touch with all those people. And then he discovered that there was some massive plan, or rather not only one, several massive networks which were operating against the interests of India. So it was at that time that he further did some research into that. And then he brought out his books like Invading the Sacred and Breaking India. Then again, thereafter, he wrote another very well received book called The Battle for Sanskrit is again something to do with our culture. Basically, if you want to denigrate a nation, if you want to destroy a culture, one way to destroy the culture is to give a dog a bad name and hang him. So that is the policy. So that way, you denigrate the culture by misinterpreting the text and then giving all types of wrong interpretations. So all those things he studied. And then again, later, one of his recent books is Artificial Intelligence, How It Is Going to Change Our Lives. And Artificial Intelligence also in the context of the national security only. And that other book, Breaking India, again, he is in the context of national security. And again, his recent book, Snakes in the Ganga. Of course, it has nothing to do with the snakes or with the Ganges, Ganga. It has something to do with the people who are sitting in Western universities, very high universities, so-called highly respected universities called Ivy League universities, and then who are having their own agenda to break various countries. So how those people are nurturing a particular atmosphere, nurturing some people. So we know these are all the old techniques only. We all know that our own Niti Shastra, whether it is Kautilya Niti Shastra or Kamandaka Niti Shastra, we are acquainted with the things called Sama, Dana, Bheda, Danda. So this Bheda, how to create divisions within a group, in a targeted group. So that is what exactly they are practicing. There's nothing new, but then we were totally unaware of it. In fact, it is our job to know, as I said, it is the job of all our intelligence agencies to know it, it is the job of our foreign officers to know that. But unfortunately, we probably skipped that. So it went upon Rajivji, the burden fell on him to study them and then to sensitize us. I really feel that he is a person who has opened the eyes of so many scholars in India, particularly Indologists. What is the role of Indian scholars? What should we do? And as Subramanianji said, we are all having one common interest, that is preserving this nation, preserving the identity or integrity of the nation. So that is, from that point of view, his books are very, very relevant to us. So that is the brief background.
Namaste. This is an amazing welcome to Hyderabad, thanks to a large group of organizers who put this very elaborate 3-day visit for us. So I'm very grateful to that, and thank you so much. This is, I'm told, this is primarily a media interaction. So I don't think it's a good idea. I'll speak a whole lot because I think your questions would be very important. And the speaker before me did a very good job summarizing in Telugu. He's also translating the book into Telugu. He tells me it's almost ready, so we are looking forward to having the translated script and then we get it published.
Good evening, sir. Good evening, madam. This is Niranjan Desai from Bharatavarsha News, a local organization. Welcome to Bhagyanagar, sir. This is not Hyderabad, this is Bhagyanagar. We proudly call it Bhagyanagar always. My question related to Infinity Foundation. Let me read the question, sir. There's a lot of indifference and ignorance among the Indian masses about the likes of the work of Infinity Foundation. I keep posting in many groups, but the traction that media, social media, but the traction that I get for this minuscule, very less compared to latest music trends in the market. And last but the least, since yesterday midnight, whole India is covering Tribular's achievement in Oscar and Natu Natu song got Oscar award. No other news in any channel you open. This is the picture. So in this situation, they don't want to know about our true history, culture, heritage. History may be economic phase, maybe different phases, that their indifference gone invite our own entire civilization. My question is, how to face it?
How to face it?
Yeah, how to bring them back to track?
So the question is that in spite of 30 years of work we've done, not hobby, not part-time, but full-time, and put all the, everything I have, tan, man, dhan, into this, and with the help of very good people like you trying to promote it also, at the end of the day, there's very little traction compared to some cricket match or some Bollywood or some some new sensation, some popular culture, excitement. So people like that. Now, what has happened, in my opinion, compared to when I was a student long ago, I think the level of thinking has gone down in the sense that there is short attention span. We used to read a lot. Then television came, so it was less. Now social media, even less. So now they tell you that you have only a few seconds to make your point. Nobody's going to read hard. But we were reading very hard in those days. Our civilization is built on traditions which require a lot of concentration, a lot of attention span. There would be discussions and debates go on for days. The big teachings are requiring serious thinking, concentration. So there is a degradation of the mind, quality of mind, the level of thinking has gone down. Now, when you have people like that, then in a democracy, you have to cater to such people in order to get elected. So the politicians have to become low in thinking and become emotional. Offer them emotional idea here, there, something very simple everybody can understand. But if you offer them a serious proposition, something long-term, an idea, concept, they're not going to understand. They're not going to vote for somebody like that. So they're going to vote for a person who talks about, you know, big, bombastic statements. So you give them very hyperbolic, very exaggerated statements, make them feel proud and make them feel good emotionally, then they will vote for you. So this is the problem it's a downward spiral of democracy requiring appeasement of people. And this requires giving them short-term, quick sensations. And the people are becoming like that, and then they're demanding more of the same. So a country like that will be ruined, because we are facing China, which is very different. China spent 50 years educating everybody for two generations. Everybody today, young people, they are educated, their parents were educated, their grandparents were educated. So third generation of educated people. And when I interact with them all over the world, they're very analytical, can concentrate, they can think for themselves, even though they don't know English, but when you speak to them in English, they come back with intelligent answers. Whereas I find that a lot of our people, you ask them some question, they give you some random answer, yama ki baat, you know, useless talk. So they're not able to think clearly. So what to do is a very serious problem. The problem is not me and the traction. Who cares about my traction? I'm talking about bigger problems like lack of education system. lack of proper values in our NCRT, the UPSC exam. I'm talking about, and you know what has happened is, as we point out in Snakes in the Ganga, the government has outsourced a lot of the thinking to foreign consultants. So even though we say we are decolonized, we're running our country politically because we are getting elected. After getting elected, we are getting all kind of advisors coming in, telling us about data security rights, national education policy, all sorts of things. We are open to others coming, taking over. Now the government is going to allow, invite foreign universities to set up campuses with no restrictions. Indian universities have restrictions, but the restrictions do not apply to the foreign universities, neither in the subject they'll teach, nor the kind of people they can hire, nor how much they can pay, or what the tuition is. So they have an advantage over the local. It is actually not a level playing field. So this is a path to self-destruction. We can keep having slogans like Vishwa Guru and so on, but we are becoming Vishwa Chela. We are becoming Vishwa Chela, following other people, and very proud that we can say Vishwa Guru, Vasudeva Kutumbakam. The glory of the rishis is great. But that's like saying, Tendulkar made centuries, but I can be out for zero. Who cares? Because Tendulkar made centuries. That is stupid, because we have to have produce thinking people today and people who are competent today. Like Arvind Jawaji said, you know, these are jobs that the national security people have to do. And they are not being vigilant about these things. So I am worried about this. And I think thinkers like you and Arvind Rawji and Mr. Raghu and many other people here, they have to now take this as a campaign to put pressure on the political people, put pressure on the government people, that they have to take these matters seriously. Otherwise, I think nothing can happen. But I would say another responsibility lies with parents to educate their children better. So, Vijaya, would you want to comment?
As far as educating our children, we've left it to the system. Not only have we left it to the system, we've also not decolonized ourselves enough. So the reason for the education policy to bring in foreign universities is that many parents are spending thousands of dollars, lakhs of rupees, to send their children overseas. So why not bring those colleges and those universities onto home turf so that, you know, they can just get educated right here. But we haven't looked at what is the kind of education we're bringing in. So we don't do due diligence at all levels. The government doesn't do due diligence to see who the experts are, who they, you know, whom are they working for, you know, what is their allegiance towards. So when you bring an Ernst & Young or somebody like that, they are not worried about India or Indian civilization or the Indian workforce. They are just doing a consulting assignment to make money for their parent company, right? So when you're trying to bring in foreign universities, it's good to do due diligence to see how have other countries handled foreign universities. For example, you don't have to take the extreme example of China, but you can look at somebody like Singapore. You can look at what Russia is doing. You can look at other countries that value their civilizational ethos. They value their education system, things like that. For example, Singapore had an MOU with Yale University. Yale NUS was a tie-up. They had an MOU for 10 years, started in 2014. And 2020, they said this was the last four-year batch. By 2024, we're going to sever the ties with Yale University. Yale is such a big brand. And they were bringing liberal arts to Singapore. But Singaporean parliament discussed it. They said, this is making our society very divisive. And therefore, we don't want Western liberal arts in Singapore. It's a wise decision. And they cut the ties with Yale University because it was not good for Singapore. They said Singaporeans are multiracial, very diverse, different ethnicities, and we've been living harmoniously for many, many decades. And we do not want Western ideas of social science to come and break our society apart. And we're a very small country. We can't afford to do this. So these are, these are big decisions that some governments take. Apparently ours doesn't. Similarly, even in the house, we don't do due diligence as to what the education our children receive, right? Whether in school, in, you know, NCERT, where are they going? If we send them abroad, what are they studying? How much are we paying? What are we getting in return? If you look at liberal arts, students from liberal arts universities overseas, when I say liberal arts also has STEM subjects, you know, pure sciences and mathematics also under liberal arts, but I'm not talking about that. I'm talking mainly about social sciences and humanities. And most of these students that graduate overseas, even from great universities like Harvard, do not get a job. If you graduate after 4 years, you know, with $250,000 in loan, student loans you have, to get a degree in gender studies or African American studies or some of these studies which come under liberal arts, you have no skill. This is unskilling India. Bringing Western liberal arts universities is actually paying money to unskill India and make activists out of our students. So this is happening overseas. They all live in their mother's basement, their parents' basements, and that's a big no-no for, you know, for the Western society. And they can't get a job, and they have student loans. So the US president has said, I will forgive all student loans just to get votes. But this is such a worthless education. So we haven't even done due diligence for that. So I think we don't do due diligence, and that goes back to the low IQ, and attention deficit sort of society that we have, and especially the younger generation.
More provocative answer. But maybe I'll make even more enemies. But, you know, think about it, consider it. Are Indians ready for democracy? I want to ask a question. Ancient India was not a democracy. We had good noble kings who did very well for our country. Western idea of democracy is itself in test because they're also having serious social problems. You see, including United States, about its democracy, about its institutions. Now, democracy was proposed in ancient times in places like Greece and so on. Those are very small. And the idea was that everybody is highly educated. If you have a very educated population, they can make these decisions for what is the best for the country. But if they are not that well informed, then they will be more emotional. So my question is this. You don't run a cricket team based on democracy of the players. They're the captain who makes decisions. You don't run an army based on the democracy of all the soldiers. It's the generals who decide. You don't run a corporate entity based on all the factory workers electing and voting, deciding what the policy will be, what the product will be, how the pricing will be. You have executives who make decisions. So if most of these, most areas that are competitive, that have to compete with other people, require subject matter experts to decide, not democracy. A surgeon does not, how a surgery will be done is decided by the most qualified people who are surgeons. You don't go to all the staff and the nurses and all these people in the hospital to vote for how to do this particular surgery because they don't know. So, you know, any expertise, whether it is medicine, whether it is cricket, whether it is, whatever, it is not decided by democracy. The court does not decide based on a democracy, what is everybody sitting in the court, what do you think, is he right, is he guilty, not guilty, it's not decided. It's decided by people who are experts. So why couldn't governance be also by people who are real subject matter experts rather than people who are popular? This is a question, it's a very provocative question. I'm not saying yes or no, but I'm asking this question that intellectuals like you should raise. We can be very proud we've done better than we were, and that is true. We are better than we were, and the government is better than the previous government, that is true. But even this government has to do a lot just to emotionally manage people, which China does not need to do. They don't have to worry about it, they can go faster. So I'm just leaving this as a food for thought for future debate.
My question to you would be very simple. My name is Suresh Kocharal, I'm from Nationalist Hub. I'm also a social media influencer, that way if you can call it. My question is simple. I come from a state called Kerala. Of course, I grew up in Hyderabad. speak Telugu fluently. My question to you is, the brainwashing which happens in universities, now we speak of JNU and you're going to one such university tomorrow or day after, I don't know, HCU. These brainwashings, we believe, starts in the colleges. But I can tell you that way back when Nehru was the Prime Minister, that time any student, and sir, the two civil service officers sitting here, any student, civil service officer who qualified from Kerala had to undergo an intelligence background check. This is the time EMS Nambudiri part was. So my question is, the brainwashing is starting at the school level in states like Kerala with the student unions and all that. So by the time a student comes to the college, they are primed to be a rebel against the system. How do we tackle this? Because I don't think it's happening in many states, but it's happening in a few states. Thank you.
I think the problem is universal in the sense that school education is not very good for the, is not very patriotic, and good history, good values are not being taught. And so it is the old education system, curriculum is not very good for children all over the country. And the parents are not very well educated about what to teach in these terms, where parents have their own jobs and they themselves have been raised in this Nehruvian idea of secularism and so on, without proper understanding of our own history. So neither the parents nor the school system teach this. And the gurus could be the only other vehicle. The gurus are just teaching their meditation and their puja, bhakti and all. They're not teaching things about nation. They're not teaching the Arth Shastra, for example. They're not teaching what are the lessons from Mahabharata that you can put in your life today. They're not teaching Dharma Shastra. They're teaching Upanishad, which is very good, Gita, which is very good, and various pujas and all that, which is all very nice. I like that. But none of the influences on the child is building this kind of character that we want, like some of the very strong countries like China are building their character. So it is being filled in by media and social media. This is raising the social media, Instagram and all these things, raising the children for, you know. So by the time they come to college, they don't even have their parents' supervision to keep an eye on them. At least at home they have that. So now they are out of the supervision of parents and they are mingling with other students. And they are trying to impress each other, peer pressure to conform. And the old guard of professors in these universities are all very left-wing types, and they move the students in that direction. So this is what the dynamics is, a very difficult thing. Now, after 8 years of new government, they have not been able to transform either the NCERT curriculum or the UPSC curriculum, or the professors in on a large enough scale, because BJP and RSS do not have a deep bench of highly qualified, trained intellectuals that can fill in these jobs, because it was not, the focus was not on creating intellectual kshatriyas. The focus of the shakha is not creating intellectuals, so that is a vacuum we don't have in our country. The left has created these ecosystem. And we have not created a sufficiently good, powerful ecosystem. So that is a dangerous situation we are facing right now. Now, things are improving, but very slowly. We don't have that much time. I don't believe that China giving us too much time. Things will happen fast. Things on the global stage are happening very quickly. And technology-wise, we're lagging behind. If you look at percent of GDP, invested in R&D. India is one of the lowest in the world, even today. So how do we catch up with technology, R&D and technology if we are not investing enough? There is money with the billionaires, but they are living good life, making profit and living good life, not putting it back into long-term R&D. What's the reason? Why are these guys who are making so much money not able to invent ChatGPT or search engines or platforms or AI engines or all the technology is coming, we are buying, importing from somewhere. There is no excuse. China, a much poorer country than India 50, 60 years ago, has educated its people, does not depend on Apple or Amazon or Google or Facebook. They have their own. And they are not only doing this very good job for domestic control of the social media for their own people, but exporting it to Africa, Latin America. Many countries are using Chinese platform. So how can we say? When I was 20 years ago, I was told that one advantage China can never have is software, because we are more creative and they are they are communist and they are not creative, but look, they have gone ahead of us in artificial intelligence. I was told that we have the English language advantage, they don't have, so we will do better. All these slogans and all the newspapers and all the politicians all over the world very proud that we are the software guru and whatnot. Point is, the reality is this. You are a software city also here, big software hub. We are supplying labor to the American multinationals to do the software which they will own. They are the owners of the intellectual property. They are the owners of the patent. We are supplying the labor. So just because we are supplying labor doesn't mean we own the technology. There's a difference between whose technology it is, which is American, and who is supplying the labor. So we have trained labor to get jobs and they bring repatriation of income and good for cities like this where you can apply, bring a lot of create jobs. It is good. But China not only supplied labor for factories, but they ended up outsmarting their client, outsmarting the Americans, building the products themselves, better, cheaper to compete against them, and learned the technology from the Americans and then went ahead. Why couldn't we do that? After all, Microsoft is here with tens of thousands of people, and I'm told Google is here and Apple is here, all these people are here. They've been here for a long time. Lakhs of our people are working. Why are we still dependent on their products and not able to build the same product ourselves in our own name? So this is, are we just followers? Are we tech coolies? I mean, are we Vishwa coolies and Vishwa chelas? Followers and doing dirty work and low-level work for the owners? Or are we, how do we call ourselves Vishwa Guru? We're certainly not Vishwa Guru technologically. We're certainly not Vishwa Guru in terms of media and discourse and academic. Who teaches, who controls the discourse on India is not people in India. These discourses are set from places like Harvard, the international discourse. So I think there are serious issues, and it's difficult to get our people to take this up seriously. That's the if you say too much, then they don't like you and they block you. This is a problem.
Also on the China issue, a couple of years ago, two decades ago, China encouraged English language education. They brought in many teachers from America to teach English. 2 years ago, 3 years ago, they said, enough, we're not going to teach our school children English anymore. We don't need that at all. In fact, the government controls science, math, and history education in China. There was an edtech company that was doing some STEM type course, and they were doing it well. Overnight, it was a publicly traded company. They made it a government, an NGO, overnight. I'm not saying we do such things, but we can learn from the trends. So China basically says that the world will be speaking Mandarin, and we don't need to teach our people English anymore. Whereas we have not even been able to make textbooks in the vernacular languages successfully. Even though we know research has shown that children actually learn better in their mother tongues. We don't have science and math in different vernacular languages even till today. Though the education policy sort of broadly talks about, oh, we should have all these courses, every subject should be taught in the vernacular. We don't have. We don't have teachers that are trained. We don't have curriculum. We don't have textbooks. We have nothing. Whereas China's on the other way. They are so aggressive that they've stopped English altogether.
My name is Kandula Ramana Reddy. I'm from Kurnool district. Itne der se education ke baare mein baat kar raha hai. In Telugu, there is a word, కూటి కోసం కోటి విద్యలు. చదువు ఈజ్ ఓన్లీ రీడింగ్ అండ్ రైటింగ్, విద్య ఈజ్ డిఫరెంట్. ఓకే, సో మెనీ పీపుల్ ఆర్ డూయింగ్ దేర్ డిగ్రీస్ అండ్ మాస్టర్ డిగ్రీస్ ఓన్లీ పుట్ దేర్ ఇన్ వెడ్డింగ్ కార్డ్స్ డిసైడ్ దేర్ నేమ్స్. ఓకే, అండ్ విద్య ఈజ్ అ డిఫరెంట్, లైక్ ఐటీఐ, వొకేషనల్ కోర్సెస్, సమ్ అదర్ దిస్ థింగ్స్. యూ సెడ్ చైనా ఈజ్ నాట్ గోయింగ్ టు గివ్ మోర్ టైమ్. Okay, in India, for manufacturing sector, there is no skilled labor today. Who is going to correct this? People are studying degrees, B.Tech in software. If you civil engineer doing software, mechanical engineer doing software, everybody is going to software side. they are studying 4 years in engineering college, and then 6 months they are doing one course in Amirpet, and then everybody is going to software companies. So our skilled manpower is not working for our country, our production, for our nation. Who is going to correct this?
So, you know, the problem is we do not have a planning mentality. The education people are educating separately. The industry is separate in what need they have. So in education is not training for industry. And the industry and the education is also, when people go abroad, they study whatever the hell they want. They're not bringing back the technology we need. China sends people, they know we need so many people of this, that technology. And they go, bring it back, they steal it, whatever they do, they bring it back because China needs it. So, you know, there is this very center, this is a benefit of a planning. Now, you can blame the center, but why not Andhra do its own planning? You could have a state level, very detailed plan saying, this is our industrial policy, this is how many engineers, how many technicians, how many people who are crane operators, how many whatever, all kind of jobs. They're not all theoretical jobs like computer science. They're not all software jobs. There are many kinds of jobs. And so you can create an industrial plan, a development plan, and an education plan all combined, and a security plan, and be a model state. I think that the states should take some leadership and develop their own strategy and show that, you know, I don't know of a single state that has done this. Take artificial intelligence, the impact of AI will be very serious. And it's all being done from the Niti Aayog, and they are Niti Aayog are getting it done by American consultants. Now, every state should have a different impact. The impact of AI on an agriculture state, on a state with making pharma, state making automobile industry, state with banking, different impact on who will lose jobs and what kind of new jobs are created and what kind of training is needed. So you take your own state. Why does Andhra not have an AI policy, its own AI policy needed by every state? You need a state-level technological commission. A commission. So the states have to take this responsibility, in my opinion.
Sir, thank you for the input, sir. I have a question to Mrs. Vijaya Vishwanathan. You've been talking about, ma'am, the due diligence at a micro level by the parents, at a macro level by the administrators. Now, from the Indian context, the hurdles are the diversity which we have and the span of control to the administrators. Now, here, Rajiv Ji was just referring to the example of Andhra Pradesh, for example. Unless and until the government, now that the administration, they are trying to number of votes across the country and all, the span of control is a problem. These are the limitations which the existing government has. What is your suggestion? Is Vedic introduction of Vedic mathematics in the NEP as one subject, or introduction of Gurukulam, which was existing before the British had come into? Do you think is that a solution for us to come back to our original winning ways?
Okay, so control, let's answer this in two parts. The first part is nothing against IAS officers or karyakartas, but if you look at something like the education policy, it is made by people, bureaucrats, right? I think it should be made by stakeholders. So a few years ago, I was in OMR in Chennai. I went to meet a friend of mine who is a chartered accountant who runs this huge outsourcing center. And so I went to the sixth or seventh floor, and there's an ocean. There were like 1,000, you know, youngsters sitting in tight cubicles with cameras. And I thought I was in a prison, and it was so claustrophobic. And I said, how? So I asked him, I said, Vidyadhar, how do these people stay here? I mean, day after day. So he says, these are the kids that get educated in the, state board. They have no skills. So after 10th or 12th, they sign a contract for 2 years. And they are basically bussed from the slums or whatever and brought in here to do transcription work. So the first year is training. And I said, after 2 years, how many people stay? What's your attrition? He said, 100%. The day their contract finishes, all of them vanish. So he says, the first year we teach, the second year we get, you know, some kind of work out of them. And that's how this game works. So he's a stakeholder. he should be part of the education policy. Or a parent who struggles to put their kids through, knows the ups and downs, ins and outs. Look at all the mothers that struggle with their children, you know, putting them through. Or somebody in who are teaching students who read history books and say, this doesn't make sense, but yet I'm forced to, you know, teach the kids. So these are people who are stakeholders, and they should be active part of the policy, not just bureaucrats. I have nothing against bureaucrats, they're really smart people, but they can't be subject matter experts from election commission to education, right? So this is something we can do. We are not doing. As far as Indic knowledge systems are concerned, I think absolutely yes. I've done it personally myself. I've educated two boys in the Western system and with Ganita Shastram, Sanskritam, things like that. Not out of nostalgia, but because of relevance. It makes them think differently. It gives a different drishti. For example, Ganita Shastram has ideas of encryption. Like you use Bhuta Sankhya where, you know, it's all in beautiful poetry. And when they say Surya or Chandra, it's one, because there's only one. So one has to sort of decrypt and say, oh, if when you see Surya, it's one. So there are ways of, and then Katapayadi system. There are different ways of encryption in Ganitam. So these are concepts that young children are exposed to. And so they're very relevant. It's not because of nostalgia. But of course, many of us ourselves have not been exposed to this kind of education. So it takes, you know, it's very difficult to find experts. So you have to first create curriculum. You have to convince parents and others that this is actually good and it benefits students. And then you have to also train teachers, because you have teachers that know Sanskritam but not Ganitam, but who know mathematics but not Sanskritam. So this is a huge task which only the government can take on. But nobody in the government knows anything about all of this. Neither will they let stakeholders and others take charge. So it's not like we can't do it, we don't have the resources, but we just don't do it in the right way.
This question is to Vijaya Vishwanathan. This is Paniharan, I'm from Hans India. When we are talking about education, I wanted to refer a few case studies. There is a general practice of women wearing flowers in their hair. It's a centuries old practice. By doing this, in fact, you know, seasonally they used to change those flowers. If we really look into the impact of it, they were really supporting hundreds of floriculture farmers. There are some women who used to come and sell, there is a lot of areas that. So this way, if you look at, say, before invasions, like Muslim invasion, the purchasing capacity of women, or this Indian women, particularly in South India, I'm telling you, this is more than vis-a-vis their counterparts in the Europe and this. But still, increasingly, if we look at into the women's studies area, these people are labeled as kitchen birds. So here, there are case studies that are there. But why is it that, you know, our women's study people are not looking at these things?
I basically think we as a generation do not understand many issues civilizationally. Because I look at the society at large, people do not understand the, you know, the ideas, the metaphysics of the Indic civilization, where everything is connected, everybody is involved, everybody has a role, everybody has an obligation to the collective. In fact, in the Varna Jati caste book, which we released just a couple of weeks ago, we talk about how, you know, you get an idea. In the West, you have identities, these sort of synthetic identities that are given based on somebody deems you marginalized, you know, or based on gender or sexuality or some other criteria, which are all sort of artificial. Whereas in the Vedic system, you got an identity when you had an obligation. So as a brahmacharya, you had a dharma. You know, this is your obligation. You know, you're supposed to study. As a grahastha, you got the identity of a grahastha only because you had an obligation, a contribution, you know, to the larger, you know, yajna, as Rajivji talks about in some of his books. So you get an identity, not for sort of rights, but you get an identity. If you're a woman, you have a stri dharma. You have a purusha, you have a purusha dharma. So even if gender, there is a dharma, a kula dharma you have. So any identity that you have, Ivarna, ashrama, whatever it is. The identity is given to you just for a brief period. It doesn't last forever. And it is there because you have a you have an offering to the collective. Right? So these are ideas that we don't understand. We just say, oh, you know, we take Western ideas and then superimpose it on our society and then struggle to find ways, and we also agree with them saying, oh yeah, yeah, these are marginalized, this is caste. We don't understand the difference between, you know, what is Varna, what is Varna Dharma, what. So these are fundamental issues with us. Going back to our very first question, we do not know who we are, we do not know where we've come from, we don't have the attention span to learn, even if we don't know. So when you're like that, then all these sort of problems are sort of the result of you know, having, you know, being ignorant about your civilizational roots.
So another question to Raju, sir. Sir, there is a kind of dichotomy which we see these days, particularly in case of Hindus. They celebrate a lot of festivals which are in a way aligned to natural geometry derived from the life-centric cosmology of Hindus or Sanatana, whatever. So on the one hand, these people celebrate all these festivals and use all the symbols, the rituals and everything goes on. On the other hand, the parents, they insist their children to be experts in physics, maths, and English, and these areas. If you really look at the background of it, you know the word phusis is there in ancient Greece. And here, Prakriti. Both are, the concepts are both are similar. Then phusis has turned into physis natura, then to physics. Means life-centric cosmology too, it was reduced to the level of materialistic cosmology. From there, the controlling of nature, all materialistic principles, science, application, all these started there on that side of the continent. So here the children are, you know, not able to grasp the overall cosmology of science. So on the one hand, they are pulled towards a materialistic direction. On the other hand, they have to keep up their own tradition. It's almost like, you know, Cartesian dichotomy that they are subjected to. How to resolve this?
So you're raising an interesting question, you know, that the practice of Dharma has reduced to symbolism. That's what you're saying. And people do not understand the metaphysics, the philosophical, the cosmological dimension, which is important. Even to understand the rituals and symbolism, you need to understand the metaphysics. People don't know. And if they understood the metaphysics, then what they are doing in physics, chemistry, math would make more sense. They would know the context. Because they would know the context in which this understanding of matter and material causation, physics is material causation, okay, that's what physics is. So material causation is very nice and very important, it's very practical, you can make engineering marvels out of it because you need to know how it works, but it is limited in what it can do. You can do a lot more if you understood cosmology, and then there are so many other higher levels of knowledge that can be very practical also. So the issue is, we don't have teachers who teach all that. So the gurus are not teaching that, and that is their job. We are giving them unlimited money. They have no shortage of money, no shortage of reputation, prestige, clout, power, none of that. No shortage of number of followers. There is no excuse for the gurus not to take on these topics and say, my job is to educate the whole masses on these matters. Because they have the adhikar, people will go to them and listen what they are saying. Even more than the government, I think the gurus have responsibility in that. That's how I feel about it. And so, you know, there's no shortage of where the problem can start being solved. But we need that initial ignition, that fire. Either government has to solve it or gurus have to solve it. Somehow it has to be solved. My worry is we're running out of time. My worry is that the solutions, capturing of the mind is going to go more and more very rapidly into algorithms controlled by foreign people. These algorithms are the new devatas. These algorithms are the new adhikaris, the new gurus. People are bowing to them in social media, and education is coming through algorithms. Judiciary, some legal system, how you hire a person, all the personnel departments are using algorithms and AI to figure out who's qualified. So we are being run by artificial intelligence, which is run by big data. And the training of these AI systems is largely being done by the people who own all these algorithms, not Indians. So we are being colonized by algorithmic colonization. This, because we are not smart enough, we are not controlling ourselves, we are not thinking strategically, others are filling that gap, that vacuum of power, which is why I wrote this book, Artificial Intelligence and the Future of Power, 5 Battlegrounds. That is what this is. Not a book or technical book. It's a book on philosophy, policy, social implications, exactly like what you're saying. You've identified a problem, that there's a gap. And in my work, I've identified that because of this gap, and we are not doing anything about it, this gap is being filled by new technology. It's like the new teacher, the new guru for us.
Hello, sir. This is Aarti Kashyap from Deccan Chronicle. The question is, as a younger generation, I want to understand, have we become less tolerant as a society now, or it has always been the case, more or less, and now we see more of it because of the social media, the things are coming up out so easily and so quickly. So has it been the same, or it has been changing? And if so, what are a few reasons that you can cite for that? Thank you.
So by less tolerant, you mean social conflicts?
Yes.
So social conflicts have already always existed, but now because people are not isolated geographically, they are all, everybody's business is everybody else's business. Everybody knows what everybody else is doing and everybody's saying. So the opportunity for conflict is more. Also, there is overpopulation, more and more people competing for fewer resources. So there is competition among communities all over the world. Now, the thing that is troubling is that the use of social media to create conflicts is being controlled by other people. It's not our people who control this social media. We do not have our own social media. So what the algorithm will support or not support and who it will deplatform is not up to you or me or anybody in this room. Even our government, they do not have control over the social media. They've sold it out. This is a very serious matter. It is the social media which created the Arab Spring uprising, the Hong Kong revolts, all the problems in very many countries, including the CAA and all these farmers things and all we had here. There were a lot of hands of the social media, and the social media is not Indian. This is very, it's a kind of a remote control management of the emotions and psychology of our people, and so you will see that these things will happen more and more. Just wait till the next election, there'll be a lot more of this.
Namaste, I'm Shailaja. I'm representing Samachar Bharati here. So one simple question. What are your views about this new American ambassador designate to India, who's already declared his intent that, you know, he's going to work on the core issues of CAA and so on? So, I mean, how do we face these external onslaughts? It is very much part of the system. So
yeah, so we've predicted this in our Breaking India 2.0. Read the book. We were telling you where it's coming from. When the moment this guy was considered, you know, this LA mayor and all that, I wrote about it, that this guy is bad news, and Indian media should have taken some of the stuff and started writing articles. Government can't stop. But if the media and the public outcry, then the foreign country thinks again. So you see, they first test by leaking a rumor that there is a rumor that Mr. X will be appointed ambassador, because they want to see what is the reaction that comes back. If the reaction coming back is very, very tough and strong, and I wrote that, but Indian media didn't want to even publish my article. Indian media did not even want to publish my article. So, you know, this thing, nobody complained, so it's all become fine. And now it is too late. Now this guy is, who is the ambassador of US going to come here, believes that he is going to negotiate on behalf of United States, not with the Indian government, but with individual communities. So he will negotiate with Khalistanis here, Sikhs, and say, okay, what do you want? Are you right? Are you wrong? It's like the British used to adjudicate disputes among Indians. British used to adjudicate. Now American guy ambassador here will have better, can invite Nagas, invite Manipur people, invite people from here, Dravidian people, invite some group here and there, Maoist, and he will hold a baithak in the embassy and say, okay, I'm going to have a seminar for human rights, I'm going to have a seminar for social justice, and I'm going to have a seminar with the Indian LGBTQ people. Now, he's going to conduct, it's like on one hand we have Chandrachud, who's doing the job of government, thinking as if he's running the government. On the other hand, we'll have the American ambassador doing this. What are we going to do? So, you know, why is the Indian government not able to think ahead? I've had many meetings with people in Delhi, and they said, we have everything going on, we are reacting, we are responding. So I told them, if you make a list of the most important 5 or 10 negative things that have happened, one is this ambassador, one is what happened in Geneva, you know, those things, one is the BBC thing, one is all these articles in American press, one is, you know, allegations from the US government that your democracy is being compromised. If you look at all these foreign interventions, how many of them were you able to predict before it happened? And this person who's the top guy, I don't want to name, he was silent. I said, you are telling me it's all under control, but you only react after it happens. You have no ability to predict. So in fact, we are predicting sometimes years in advance and you're not taking it seriously. So this is a serious problem I have with the current dispensation, with all due respect to them.